Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, August 16th, 2022. President Joe Biden signing into law that $740 billion bill designed to increase access to health insurance and reduce prescription drug costs, promote clean energy and cut greenhouse gas emissions that lead to climate change, and pay for it and more with tax increases on large companies. The president saying it's about showing that America and American democracy works. The promise of this nation is real. The Inflation Reduction Act is not just about today. It's about tomorrow. This is a bill that passed the House and Senate with only Democratic votes, solid opposition from Republicans. We'll hear from the president in just a moment and some of those Republicans. President Biden returning to Washington from his vacation in South Carolina to sign this bill, but First Lady Jill Biden staying behind after testing positive for COVID-19. We'll get an update on the status of the pandemic from the White House COVID-19 response coordinator, Dr. Ashish Jha. A judge in Florida scheduling a hearing later this week on whether to unseal the probable cause affidavit that led to the search warrant for former President Donald Trump's home in Florida, during which the FBI took back boxes of official documents, some marked classified. How are voters viewing the developments of this search of Mar-a-Lago? We'll talk about that with a Washington Post reporter. Iran officially responding to a European Union negotiated plan to get the U.S. back into the Iran nuclear agreement. We'll hear from the U.S. State Department on that. And on this 45th anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll, we go into the C-SPAN's archives for a visit to Graceland, his mansion in Memphis, Tennessee. This from CBS News, President Joe Biden signing the Inflation Reduction Act into law at the White House on Tuesday, finalizing a landmark piece of legislation aimed at fighting climate change, lowering health care costs, and raising taxes on corporations. House and Senate passed the bill along party lines last week after Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer struck a deal after many months of negotiations. Here's President Biden at the White House.
The bill I'm about to sign is not just about today. It's about tomorrow. It's about delivering progress and prosperity to American families. It's about showing the American and the American people that democracy still works in America, notwithstanding all the talk of its demise. Not just for the privileged few, but for all of us. You know, I swore an oath of office to you and to God to faithfully execute the duties of this sacred office. To me, the critical duty of the president is to defend what is best about America. And that's not hyperbole. Defend what's best about America, to pursue justice, to ensure fairness, deliver results that create possibilities, possibilities that all of us can live a life of consequence and prosperity in a nation that's safe and secure. That's the job. Fulfilling that pledge to you guides me every single hour of every single day in this job. No, presidents should be judged not only by our words, but by our deeds. Not by our rhetoric, but by our actions. Not by our promise, but by reality. And today is part of an extraordinary story that's being written by this administration and our brave allies in the Congress. This law that I'm about to sign finally delivers on a promise that Washington has made for decades to the American people. I got here as a 29-year-old kid. We were promising to make sure that Medicare would have the power to negotiate lower drug prices back then. Back then, prescription drug prices. But guess what? We're giving Medicare the power to negotiate those prices now on some drugs. This means seniors are going to pay less for the prescription drugs. While we're changing circumstances for people in Medicare by putting a cap of a maximum of $2,000 a year on their prescription drug costs, no matter what the reason for that, for those prescriptions are. That means if you're on Medicare, you'll never have to pay more than $2,000 a year, no matter how many prescriptions you have, whether it's for cancer or any other disease. No more than $2,000 a year. And you all know it because a lot of you come from families that need this. This is a godsend. This is a godsend to many families and so, so long overdue. The Inflation Reduction Act locks in place lower health care premiums for millions of families who get their coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Last year, a family of four saved on average $2,400 through the American Rescue Plan that I signed into law that the Congress voted in place. In the years ahead, thanks to the Inflation Reduction Act, 13 million people are going to continue to save an average of $800 a year on health insurance. The Inflation Reduction Act invests $369 billion to take the most aggressive action ever in confronting the climate crisis and strengthening our energy security. It's going to offer working families thousands of dollars in savings by providing them rebates to buy new and efficient appliances, weatherize their homes, get tax credit for purchasing heat pumps and rooftop solar, electric stoves, ovens, dryers. It gives consumers a tax credit to buy electric vehicles or fuel cell vehicles, new or used. And it gives them a tax credit of up to $7,500 if those vehicles were made in America. American auto companies, along with American labor, are committing their treasure and their talent, billions of dollars in investment, to make electric vehicles and battery and electric charging stations all across America, made in America, all of it made in America. This new law also provides tax credits that's going to create tens of thousands of good-paying jobs and clean energy manufacturing jobs, solar factories in the Midwest and the South, wind farms across the plains and off our shores, clean hydrogen projects and more all across America, every part of America. This bill is the biggest step forward on climate ever. And it's going to allow us to boldly take additional steps toward meeting all of my climate goals and the ones we set out when we ran. It includes ensuring that we create clean energy opportunities in frontline and fence line communities that have been smothered by the legacy of pollution, and fight environmental injustice that's been going on for so long. And here's another win for the American people. In addition to cutting the deficit by $350 billion last year, my first year in office, and cutting it $1.7 trillion this year, this fiscal year, we're going to cut the deficit, point out, by another $300 billion with the Inflation Reduction Act over the next decade. We're cutting deficits to fight inflation by having the wealthy and big corporations finally begin to pay part of their fair share. Big corporations will now pay a minimum of 15% tax instead of us 55 of them got away with paying $0 in federal income tax on $40 billion in profit. And I'm keeping my campaign commitment. No one, let me emphasize, no one earning less than $400,000 a year will pay a penny more in federal taxes. Folks, the Inflation Reduction Act does so many things that for so many years, so many of us have fought to make happen. And let's be clear. In this historic moment, Democrats sided with the American people, and every single Republican in the Congress sided with the special interest in this vote. Every single one.
President Joe Biden, part of his remarks today in the state dining room of the White House before signing into law the bill that he talked about. Also in that bill to increase revenue to the government, $80 billion for the Internal Revenue Service, allowing the IRS to hire thousands of agents and also update its technology. Some members of Congress joining President Biden at the White House, all Democrats. As he mentioned, only Democrats voted for this. Congress is not in session today, actually out for the August recess, also known as the district work period, returning for legislative business second week in September. But a couple of Republican members going on cable news shows to talk about this bill on the day that it is signed. Congressman Buddy Carter, Republican from Georgia, who was a pharmacist, was on Fox Business Channel talking about the health care provisions.
The Hippocratic Oath tells us do no harm. And what the Democrats have done here is to do harm. Look, we all want to bring prescription drug prices down. No one more than I do. I was the one on the other side of the counter who had to tell the patients how much their medicine was going to be. I watched senior citizens as they made a decision between paying for their medicine and paying for their grocery. I saw the mother who was in tears because she couldn't afford the antibiotic for her child. So I want to bring prescription prices down, but this is not the way to do it. This will kill innovation. It will kill research and development. In over 40 years of practice in pharmacy, I've seen nothing short of miracles as a result of research and development. We cannot afford to lose that hope of having cures for ALS, for cancer, for Alzheimer's. We've got to have that. But this bill, it's going to result in fewer cures because we're not going to have the research and development that we need in order to have innovation.
Congressman Buddy Carter, Republican from Georgia, on Fox Business Channel this morning. Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana, was on Fox News Channel Monday night talking about the climate and energy portions of this new law.
I say that the president and Senator Manchin's tax and spending bill is a massive transfer of capital from the pockets of the American people to the Green New Deal. And it's going to cause energy prices to go up. And you know how much it's going to reduce world temperatures? Zero. None. Nada. Because India and China and Indonesia and Russia and Sub-Saharan Africa and South America will continue to emit CO2. So Americans get to sacrifice. They get the spinach without any of the dessert, and that's the way I think most fair-minded people see it.
Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana, on Fox News Channel Monday night. White House says that President Biden will be traveling across the country to highlight what's in the bill he signed into law today, $740 billion, covering climate, energy, health care, tax changes. And the White House says there's going to be a larger event, White House calling it a celebration, on September 6th. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 239, NASDAQ down 25, S&P up 8. Education Department announcing plans to forgive $3.9 billion in federal student loans for over 200,000 borrowers who went to ITT Technical Institute between 2005 and the school's closing in 2016. Education Department saying that ITT engaged in widespread and pervasive misrepresentations related to the ability of students to get a job or transfer credits. Food and Drug Administration today finalizing a rule that allows hearing aids to be sold over the counter, as they put it, without the need for a medical exam, prescription, or a fitting adjustment by an audiologist, potentially saving people thousands of dollars for hearing aids. Congress passed a law to allow this back in 2017. It's taken until now to put it into effect. Vice President Kamala Harris posting this video.
Greetings, everyone. Lowering costs is one of our administration's highest priorities, and that includes healthcare costs. To that end, the FDA has issued a new rule to allow hearing aids to be sold over the counter. Soon, Americans with mild to moderate hearing loss will be able to buy their hearing aids at the local drugstore or pharmacy. No prescription needed. This change will make it easier for millions of Americans with hearing loss, including many seniors, to receive the care they need. And it will also reduce the cost of a pair of hearing aids by hundreds or even thousands of dollars. Every American has a right to receive affordable health care. Today, our administration has taken another step forward in our fight to protect that right. Take care.
Vice President Kamala Harris in a posted video. President Biden saying in a statement that those over-the-counter hearing aids could be ready for purchase at the pharmacies and stores as early as mid-October. And the FDA says almost 30 million adults in the U.S. could benefit from hearing aids. White House announcing today that First Lady Jill Biden tested positive for COVID-19. That she's experiencing mild symptoms, that she, like President Biden, has been twice vaccinated and twice boosted with the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. She's been prescribed the antiviral drug Paxlovid and will isolate at the South Carolina vacation home where she, the president, and the family have been for at least 5 days and will return home after she receives two consecutive negative COVID tests. She is 71 years old. It was just last week that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention eased its guidance on how to avoid getting COVID and what do you do when you test positive, saying that coronavirus now poses a much lower risk of severe illness, hospitalization, and death compared to earlier in the pandemic. The White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator, Dr. Ashish Jha, talked about this in a conversation today hosted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
The guidance has changed really because of two reasons. One is we have learned a ton more in the last 6 months, 8 months about how the virus spreads, what are the major modes of spread, and what are the things that we can do to protect ourselves and those around us. And I'll talk in a second about what that has meant in terms of new guidance. The second is, of course, the situation has changed in terms of how widespread vaccines and vaccinations are, what's happening with variants, what's happening with therapeutics. Put all of that together and CDC felt that it was time for an update. So what did they say in their update? Well, in general, at a high level, what I would say is that the CDC guidance sort of relaxes a lot of the restrictions we've had. Tells us that there's a really new way of thinking about who is going to get infected. We used to spend a lot of time talking about 6 feet of distance, 15 minutes of being together. You know, we realized that's actually not the right way to think about this. That's not the kind of the most accurate way to think about this. What we know about this virus, particularly these very contagious subvariants that are out there right now, is it's really about the quality of air you're breathing around you in a crowded indoor space with poor ventilation. You can get infected within minutes. If you're outdoors, with obviously by definition good ventilation, you can be outside for long periods of time and not get infected. So context matters, crowds matter, ventilation matters. That is a major new update in the CDC guidance. The other major updates are less quarantining, more about even if you're exposed, you can go on with your life. If you've been exposed, you should wear a mask, test, but you don't have to quarantine. Last but not least, is there some important changes about isolation, about being able to test and to end your isolation earlier, to stop wearing masks if you have multiple negative tests. So there are important updates, but generally moving us closer to a more normal way of living.
Dr. Ashish Jha is the White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator today at a program hosted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. The interviewer was the chamber's president, Suzanne Clark, and she asked him to look ahead to this coming winter, a time when people congregate indoors and viruses spread.
In thinking about preparing for winter, you know, we're looking at what's going on in Australia right now, and people are calling it, you know, kind of a, what's the word, twindemic, right? That they're having a huge flu spike at the same time that they're having this big COVID spike. And so two questions, is that how we should be thinking about winter here? And if so, how do we prepare for it from a public health standpoint, but also from a business standpoint? How are we preparing to run our businesses, serve our customers in what could be a tough winter?
Yeah. So let's talk about flu and how it interacts with COVID. So we've had two winters where we've had relatively little flu, almost no flu. Fantastic. And by the way, why did we have two winters with little to no flu? It's actually because of all the mitigation that we put in. There was actually still a good amount of mask wearing in both winters. There was a good amount of social distancing, avoiding those large crowds. That is going to be different this winter. I expect this fall and winter to look much more like the fall and winter of 2019 than the last 2 years, with a lot less mitigation. And that means we should be ready for more flu and more COVID. Now, 2 points here. One is, under normal non-pandemic times, flu really stretches our healthcare system. Before I took on my current job, I was working as a hospitalist in the VA healthcare system and other systems I've worked in. I'll tell you, in December, January, when I was in the hospital, it was packed. It was always packed because of the flu. Throw in COVID on top of that, our healthcare system is going to get into serious trouble unless we are very proactive about preventing it. So if we do nothing and just sort of hope for the best, I think we could end up getting into a lot of trouble this fall and winter. So here's how we're thinking about preventing that. First of all, I think it's going to be really, really important for people to get this updated, very specific COVID vaccine, because I think it's going to help a lot in preventing infections, and I think it's going to help a lot in keeping people out of the hospital. Second, it's going to be really important for people to get the flu shot. I know I've now talked to you about two shots and nobody loves shots, except two shots to prevent you from ending up in the hospital where you'd end up getting a lot more shots. is, in my mind, the best deal there is. And they're both going to be widely available and free. So that's one part. Second is, I do think we have to make real efforts at mitigation. And what do I mean by that? One of the most important things we should be doing, and I think business leaders need to be doing it, school leaders need to be doing it, is improving indoor air quality. I mentioned earlier with the CDC guidance, recognition that poor quality ventilation is a major cause of spread. We should be doing a lot to upgrade ventilation in indoor airspaces. If we do that, I think that'll make an enormous difference. You know, I can imagine in crowded indoor spaces, people being encouraged to wear high quality masks. I think that will keep infections down. And then widespread availability of testing. So when people are infected, when people get sick, they test. If they're testing positive, either for the flu or for COVID, that they are not then don't go out and infect other people. Last but not least, making sure we have plenty of treatments so that people don't end up in the hospital. If we do all of those things, I am confident we keep every business open, we keep every school open, we don't have to like have hospitals that are overwhelmed and can't take care of other people, and we can get through what might be a tough fall and winter.
Dr. Ashish Jha is the White House COVID-19 Response Coordinator. An interview with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce President Suzanne Clark today. The CDC website about COVID-19 shows the U.S. currently experiencing about 95,000 new COVID-19 cases per day in August and 400 deaths per day. This is Washington Today. Iran, writes the Associated Press, Tuesday submitted a written response to what has been described as a final roadmap to restore its tattered nuclear deal with world powers. Iran's state-run IRNA news agency offered no details on the substance of its response, but suggested that Tehran still wouldn't take the European Union mediated proposal, despite warnings that there would be no more negotiations. Some questions about this today at the State Department briefing in Washington with the spokesperson, Ned Price.
So presumably you've had a chance to take a look at the response to the EU text. What do you make of it?
Well, some of you have heard this from us already today, but we have in fact received Iran's comments on the EU's proposed final text. We have received them through the EU. We're in the process of studying them. We are at the same time engaged in consultations with the EU and our European allies on the way ahead. All throughout this process, from its earliest days, we've taken a deliberate, we've taken a principled approach to the negotiations with the remaining JCPOA participants. And more recently, since this deal has essentially been on the table since March, we've known what a final deal on mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA would look like. And I made this point yesterday, but it bears repeating. We agree with the High Representative. We agree with Mr. Borrell's fundamental point. What could be negotiated over the course of these past 16, 17 months has been negotiated. So we'll continue to study what has been submitted. We'll continue to consult closely with the EU, with our European allies, other partners, and when we have more to say, we'll share that.
Okay. Well, I mean, when you say what could be negotiated has been negotiated, that would suggest that this is it, that if Iran doesn't say yes unreservedly to this text, that it's dead.
Well, this will be up to the EU as the mediator and the arbiter to have a say on that question. But I will make the point that these are not simple issues. These are not issues that can be entertained or tabled without, for example, the consultations that we've had with the EU over the past several weeks, where the parties have had an opportunity to ask questions of the coordinator, to seek additional clarity, to seek additional information. And that's just because of the very complex and by definition complicated nature of the issues that are on the table. So,
but if what could be negotiated has already been negotiated, that by definition that would imply that there is nothing left to negotiate, and that if Iran wants to reopen any part of this, they're out of luck.
Broadly speaking, we agree with Mr. Borrell.
State Department spokesman Ned Price getting questions from reporters in the State Department briefing room in Washington. More from the Associated Press story, they write that the IRNA, which is a state-run news agency in Iran, reporting that the differences are on three issues in which the United States has expressed its verbal flexibility in two cases, but it should be included in the text, and that the third issue is related to guaranteeing the continuation of the deal, which depends on the realism of the United States. The only details provided about what the written response is from Iran to the EU negotiated framework. And also AP adds this, the EU has been the go-between in the indirect talks as Iran refused to negotiate directly with America since then President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the accord in 2018. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A story at CNN, the federal magistrate judge who approved the Mar-a-Lago search warrant will hold a hearing Thursday at the court in Florida to discuss requests to unseal investigators' possible cause affidavit, which the Justice Department has opposed releasing. The federal judge on Friday unsealed the search warrant and property receipt from the FBI search of former President Donald Trump's resort in Palm Beach, Florida, a move the Justice Department backed. But on Monday, the DOJ said it opposed releasing the affidavit, specifically in an effort to protect witnesses and keep grand jury proceedings confidential. The FBI recovered 11 sets of classified documents from its search, including some materials marked as top secret SCI, one of the highest levels of classification, according to documents from the search warrant that was released on Friday. That from CNN. U.S. House Republicans have, by and large, been joining former President Trump in criticizing the FBI search, promising investigations if they win majority control of the U.S. House and the committees after this November's elections. Congressman James Comer of Kentucky, currently ranking member on the Oversight and Reform Committee, was interviewed today on Fox News.
We certainly need to tone down the temperature. The temperature's been too high for a long time. And for the FBI to do what they did, when clearly 50% of America strongly supports Donald Trump, without giving any explanation, not just to the American people, but to the leadership in Congress, is very disturbing. It shows that the distrust of the federal government is an all-time high, especially among conservatives. And the fact that the FBI would raid former President Trump's residence for documents that we don't know which documents they are in question here. And then the very next day, the American people watch Hunter Biden, who we know has committed countless crimes with our adversaries across the globe, boarding a plane on Air Force One with his father. Is very disturbing to the American people, and it's only making the temperature higher in America at a time when we need to cool down.
Well, the DOJ is asking a federal judge to keep the affidavit sealed. They say to protect the integrity of an ongoing law enforcement investigation that implicates national security. And really the implication there is that Trump was undermining national security in some sort of way. But if the public never sees the affidavit, we'll never know why.
Well, we're going to do everything in our ability to be transparent with the American people. Jim Jordan is committed to that on Judiciary Committee. I'm committed to that on the Oversight Committee. Again, knowing what we have on Hunter Biden, and I am confident the FBI has the exact same information that we have on Hunter Biden. The fact that they have still, to this day, after having all the hundreds of bank violations, after having all of the visitor logs with the White House, the travel logs with Hunter Biden, all the deposits that he's received from foreign countries all over the globe that are not our friends, and the FBI to do nothing with Hunter Biden, but then raid President Trump's residence over some missing documents is very concerning. It shows a double standard, and it would lead people to believe that the FBI has become political and is launching an attack against President Biden's number one political adversary.
From a Washington Post article, when Attorney General Merrick Garland addressed the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago last week, he took pains to emphasize that the Justice Department was applying the law evenly without fear or favor. Some swing voters aren't buying it. On the phone now is the reporter on that piece, Theo Meyer, national political reporter and co-author of the early 202 newsletter at The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us. This story is just a week old, but how is it playing with those voters?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to tell precisely through, through polling or other means, because the details, that have emerged keep changing. We know much more, of course, now than we did a week ago due to the release of the search warrant and, more details that have come out about exactly what investigators were looking for. But these were 10 swing voters who were convened in two different focus groups on Monday evening by a set of progressive groups. We were allowed to observe the session, on the condition that we not identify the sponsors or the participants. And these swing voters were very skeptical, of Garland's claim that there's no political influence here, that he is solely investigating, where the facts may lead.
So if that's the case, what does it mean as Democrats move forward with talking about this issue to these voters?
As my colleague Mariana Sotomayor has reported, Democrats have been discussing how exactly to talk about this with the midterms less than 3 months away. There was a meeting at the DCCC on Wednesday to talk through, what strategy to take, how much Democrats should be talking about this on the campaign trail. I think the conclusion was that, they don't want to be talking about Trump too much. The loss of the Virginia governor's race, in which Terry McAuliffe really played up the Trump issue last year, I think is still fresh in the minds of many Democrats.
When it comes to this issue versus other issues that swing voters are concerned about, how might it compare to, say, the economy?
Well, I think Democrats are certainly running on the repeal, or not repeal, the rollback of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court earlier this year. You have to look no further than the special election in New York's Hudson Valley that's coming up next week to see that Democrats are really going all in on the messaging there, as well as the message that even if the economy is tough for many Americans right now. And that's certainly something that that I heard a lot of in these focus groups last night, that that it's slowly turning the corner. The voters in these focus groups, did not seem especially amenable, at least most of them, to, the idea that the economy is turning a corner, that things are starting to get better. Although, some of them were a little bit more on board with that point of view than others.
We're talking with Theo Meyer from The Washington Post. More information is coming out about the search of Mar-a-Lago every day. Was there a sense among these swing voters that their judgments are baked in, or they're open to hearing as more information comes out?
That's a good question. They seem to me to be pretty open to taking in new information. A lot of them really emphasize that it's sort of unclear from, the details that have come out so far, what exactly, these documents contained, how justified the Justice Department may have been in doing this search. So they certainly seemed open to new information, asked whether the Justice Department should stop doing this. One man who was pretty skeptical of the whole thing said, "We've opened the can of worms. We've got to go ahead and see what's in there."
And finally, did you get a sense of how difficult it was to find swing voters? How many are left in the U.S.?
Well, they used a very particular definition of swing voters here. These are people who voted for Trump in 2016, but did not vote for him in 2020, or voted for him in 2020, but regretted it. So I know there are, certainly voters who identify as swing voters, but vote for Democrats almost all of the time, or, Republicans almost all of the time. So these were people who had supported Trump in the past, but, no longer necessarily support him. Some of them clearly, were more Trump sympathetic than others. One woman said that she, voted for him in 2016, but would never do so again.
Theo Meyer is a national political reporter and co-author of the early 202 newsletter at the Washington Post. Find his stories at WashingtonPost.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Congresswoman Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming, one of the 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach former President Trump and now vice chair of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol, facing a tough Republican primary today in Wyoming. CBS reporter Robert Costa posting this video in Jackson, Wyoming, after Liz Cheney voted. She was accompanied by her father, former Congressman and Vice President Dick Cheney.
What's at stake today, Congresswoman?
Well, look, I think today, no matter what the outcome is certainly the beginning of a battle that is going to continue and is going to go on. And as a country, we're facing very challenging and difficult times. We're facing a moment where our democracy really is under attack and under threat. And those of us across the board, Republicans, Democrats, and Independents, who believe deeply in freedom and who care about the Constitution and the future of the country, I think have an obligation to put that above party. And I think that fight is clearly going to continue and clearly going to go on.
Cool. Congresswoman Liz Cheney in Jackson, Wyoming, with CBS News reporter Robert Costa. C-SPAN spoke this morning with WyoFile reporter Mike Koshmerl about whether Liz Cheney has a path to victory today.
There's some analysts who have tried to cut up the numbers in a way that suggests that it is possible, but the kind of more ordinary polling, and there's been three statewide polls, suggest that she's behind 20 to 30 points. In rural Wyoming, which is most of Wyoming, she will certainly lose by a pretty wide margin. In the larger cities, which here are only 50 or 60,000 people, it might be more of a mixed bag, but hard to say. Certainly the most polls show she's quite a ways behind.
Much of the focus in the national media is on Liz Cheney, but explain who the expected next member of Congress from that at-large district is. Who's Harriet Hageman?
Harriet Hageman is a natural resources attorney who she's kind of made a name for herself suing agencies, standing up for private property rights out here in Wyoming, which is a big state for private property rights. And she comes from a political pedigree like Liz Cheney. Her father was a member of the Wyoming legislature. She had a previous go at politics herself. The last election here, she ran for governor, came in third, and probably wouldn't have been a candidate here except for Donald Trump coming in and handpicking her to run against Cheney, who is one of his many sworn enemies.
Some Democrats also calling for Democrats to be involved in this primary. What role could Wyoming Democratic voters play?
Yeah, so Democrats can go to any polling station and change their registration day of. Some of the analyses that have showed Liz Cheney does have a chance suggest that she'd need about 30,000 Democrats to cross over or independents to register as Republicans in the days leading up to today and today. And so that's the big wild card. I guess there's not great real-time data tracking those number of crossover voters. And so, yeah, it'll keep it exciting to see how many people actually do that.
Mike Koshmerl is a reporter with WyoFile, joining C-SPAN on this morning's Washington Journal. Polls close in Wyoming, 7 p.m. Central Time, 9 p.m. Eastern. A new poll by the University of North Florida's Public Opinion Research Lab finds that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, leading former President Donald Trump in a hypothetical 2024 presidential primary contest in Florida, 47% to 45%, with 7% saying they would vote for someone else. Today is the 45th anniversary of the death of rock and roll icon Elvis Presley. C-SPAN visited Presley's estate, Graceland, in Memphis, Tennessee, a couple of years ago for a tour with Angie Marchese, Vice President of Archives and Exhibits.
In the archives at Graceland, we have over 1.5 million artifacts, everything from documents to books to wardrobe. The space is around 3,000 square feet, and it really gave us the opportunity to explore the collection and display things that might have never been seen before. A lot of our visitors, of course, want to see jumpsuits. So we've got over 30 of them on display throughout Elvis Presley's Memphis. It's what people really connect with because of shows and concerts and what they remember. The cars are huge. If you're not an Elvis fan, there's a lot of people that just love the car collection because he has such an amazing collection of cars. Probably the biggest part of our collection, or the biggest item in our collection, besides the mansion, would be the Lisa Marie airplane, which that's always a big hit. Elvis buys the plane in 1975 and uses it over 200 times in 2 years. And as you're driving down Elvis Presley Boulevard, you can't help but see it sitting right on the boulevard. Probably one of the pieces that I thought I would never, ever get a chance to see would be the cape that goes with Elvis's aloha from Hawaii Eagle jumpsuit that he wore in January of 73. At the very end of the show, Elvis tosses into the audience the cape that he has on during the final song, and it changed hands a couple of times, was in a private collection. When the owner passed, he actually willed it back to the estate. So the owner passed of cancer. His name was Andy Kern. He was in Florida. After his passing, his mom calls and says Andy had something that he wanted to donate to Graceland, and a week later, the cape was here. And his only condition was that it always be on display and always have his name attached to it. So it was pretty amazing. We actually got that back in 1995, and it's only missing one stone. Keep It Up with the Archives is not just displaying things and having things tell stories. It's also, there's a lot of care, a lot of preservation and restoration work that goes on. We've had several items restored over the years, including original musical equipment that's on display in the Archives experience. There's also a car that probably was the most difficult thing we ever did. It was the 1973 Stutz Blackhawk. It's the last car Elvis drove. And we worked with a company in North Carolina, had the car shipped there, under hush-hush conditions. We didn't want anyone to know what was going on. It took several months trying to find the right tires and the right parts and everything that was needed to actually do the proper preservation of the car. It was really difficult simply because it was one of the biggest projects we had taken on.
Angie Marchese is Vice President of Archives and Exhibits at Elvis Presley's Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee, part of C-SPAN's American History TV tour of cities. In 2018, we stopped by Graceland. You can find the full video and see all the artifacts mentioned at cspan.org. Search for Elvis Presley. The Commercial Appeal newspaper in Memphis writing that a polyglot international multitude crowded Elvis Presley Boulevard on Monday night for the annual Graceland Candlelight Vigil to mark the 45th anniversary of the death of the singer, whose music and image continue to maintain an unparalleled grip on popular culture and commerce, and that members of fan clubs from Argentina, Brazil, Canada, Chile, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, and Scotland among the honor guard that lined the driveway. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter, Word for Word, to get more of Washington's top stories sent to you every day. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.